Have you made an honest review? Jump onto fifthwrist.com and read real takes by real owners about their watches. And of course, get involved and write about what's on your wrist. Fifthwrist.com is your independent space to talk watches.
Welcome to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today I'm flying solo as a host, but I am very excited for today's conversation. The person we're about to meet, he's possibly one of my oldest horological watch friends. He's a great guy. He's an avid watch collector based in LA. He's a musician. He's a podcast host. He's a real estate mogul. He's just a great guy. Please welcome Scott Goldman to Fifth Wrist Radio. Hello, Scott. So good to see you, man.
Hey, Roman. Good to see you too, buddy. It's been a long time.
It has. I was trying to reflect on how long we've known each other. Now, people outside of this won't know, but my first podcasting experience was actually as a guest on your show. Back. Do you remember when that was? What year was that?
So I think we did a Watch Geek time with you. It's got to be at least 6 years now.
Yes.
At least.
Yes.
I had my Australian co-host Jody on, and
yeah, big time.
And, and you know, Jody is actually, he's moved on. He is making custom guitars.
Oh wow.
He still collects watches, but the last time I reached out to him and said, hey, should we do another Watch Geek time? He's like, oh man, I'm making guitars. I don't got time for that.
Yeah.
And then a week later, he said, "Okay, let's do it."
Yeah, yeah. No, look, I'm glad to hear, because I remember last time we touched base about Jody. I know he was involved with the bushfires that you guys had, the terrible fires. So, yeah. So I'm glad he's doing all right.
Right. And he lost half of the house that he was in, but he's doing great now. They rebuilt the house. Yeah, we have a little bit of issues with fires, like you guys down there. But this is what happens, unfortunately, in our world. So,
no, look, I'm really glad he's doing all right. It was always nice to get the touch of Australian flavor into the podcast. It was great. Yeah. But the Watch Geek Time podcast, you would have been one of the first. I was talking to a friend of mine, shout out to Watch Adventure, Tom, about a week and a half ago, and he said to me, and he lives just outside of Melbourne, but he's like, you know, the first time I met you, I knew your voice because I heard you on Scott's podcast. And to date, that's probably the only time I've been recognized in inverted commas for my voice. Anyway, so you've made a lasting legacy, my man.
That's very kind. You know, you and I have such a huge layer of folks that we have in common, you know. Everyone from David Walter, who's maybe a very obscure name to most of your listeners.
Not to my listeners.
David Walter is one of the great living clockmakers.
My listeners are very discerning.
Oh, yeah, but David Walter's kind of an obscure guy unless you've actually spoken about him.
Yeah, 100%. No, 100%. Look, David's a modern-day Breguet-style genius, but you're right, exactly. Very sub rosa,
absolutely.
Very underground. Yeah, very, very much so.
Unbelievable student of Breguet, without question. I mean, and I've gone up to visit David a couple times.
Oh,
and he's
have you?
Just
cool.
A super sweet guy.
Very cool.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, Tim.
Jackson, yeah.
Tim Jackson, another common pal of ours. He has opened up my world. Opened up my eyes to the whole independent watchmaking world. And this is going on 17 or 18 years ago now. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's really.
David's an amazing guy. And David is like a grandfather clock, as you know. And he's like, you know, big guy. You know,
strapping lad. Yeah. Nah, look, he's a good man. It's really exciting, actually. I mean, we're veering off into LA culture now. But like the California in particular has a real kind of nexus of horological appreciation, and particularly independent horology, probably thanks to guys like Tim with Independent in Time and stuff like that. But there seems to be this passionate collecting community and now making community with David Walter and Josh Shapiro and, you know, Artur Akhmaev and a few others. Yeah.
Well, you know, you mentioned Josh, you know, Josh in the tradition of a Vuutilainen. You know, look what Josh is doing with dial work.
Yeah,
and Josh is a local boy. And yeah, it's interesting. I'll just show you a picture real quick. This is the first time I've seen this today. I guess Kari's putting out a one-off world watch.
Look at the
dial.
That's crazy. Yeah, that's really crazy.
I mean, what these guys are doing with these 300-year-old Rose engine machines, Josh is an incredible Renaissance guy. And the fact that he's doing it here in L.A., like you mentioned, it makes me feel good. There's another gentleman here, Weiss.
Cameron Weiss. Yeah, yeah, of course.
Cameron, he's also here. He and Josh do stuff together. But Josh is making dials for the guy I just mentioned. So
yes.
David Walter, who's working on a watch, Josh is going to be doing his dial. So it's a nice community that you and I are part of. And I think Tim Jackson has played an instrumental role in bringing a lot of these people together.
Yeah, definitely. And shout out to Independent in Time. For anyone who's listening and not sure who we're talking about, check out Independent in Time in Solana Beach, I think it is, in California, but definitely Instagram and online.
The store is, he's the West Coast Martin Pooley, really.
Yes. And big shout out to Martin as well. When you and I start talking, we have so many points of connection. It's crazy. Now, we've veered off way too deep, way too fast. Step one, we usually do a wrist check. We always do a wrist check. I'm particularly excited for the wrist check we're going to do today, man. All right, lay it on me.
Okay.
What have you got? Tell our listeners.
Okay, you know, it's a full moon tonight, so we had to put on the Celine.
Yeah, baby. Martin Braun, Celine.
I think my host might have something similar.
Yes. Well, usually
not that we
don't
got the memo or anything.
Right? No, I was going to say, usually we don't coordinate wrist checks, but we did coordinate a wrist check. So I have the other version of the Martin Braun Celine. I have the meteorite dial version, which is absolutely lovely. Absolutely lovely.
With the moon at 12.
Yep, with the moon of 12. We'll put some pictures in. Pictures in show notes.
I love the variation. I love the variations of the Celine, you know. Fortunate enough to be close with Marty.
Yes.
Who gave this to me.
Oh, amazing.
And it's not usual for me to have a watchmaker give me one of their watches, but this one has a very, you know, special place in my heart. He's one of my best friends in this world. I don't know what else to say. He's just one of the most special guys I know. People will say to me, "Oh my God, Scott, you know Martin Braun? Oh my God, oh my God." I'm like, "Yeah, don't get drunk with him. You won't be so happy to know him."
Is that right? Is he a pro with that kind of can hold it?
He's a nutter.
Salute to all our German friends.
There's this mystique.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's this weird mystique amongst the connoisseurs like you and I that these watchmakers are something special. My God, Ikari is a very affable guy until he gets some booze in him, and then he's just the most obnoxious human being you've ever met in your life, you know? So they're just like us. People who think that they're not like us. I guess if you wear one of these over your eye all day, you're
Well, you need alcohol if you wear a loop over your eye all day. You need to zoom out. You need to expand your consciousness somehow, right? Surely. But it does bring – I mean, so you and I was trying – once again, I was trying to reflect on how we bonded. We must have – how did we meet? Did we meet on Purist Pro or something? Like what was our – how did we –
My recollection is I think you reached out to me because I'd written an article about Martin.
Yes, maybe that's what it was.
On Purist Pro.
Yeah.
And you have, my understanding is you have an EOS.
I do, right here. Right here.
Yep. So let's show it. And the EOS probably is in need of some service.
Yes, that's what it was. You're right. See, clever man. You're right. Exactly.
So that's what my memory tells me. And I reached out to Martin and I said, "Our good friend Roman needs service for his EOS." And he said, "Yeah, him and about 17,500 other people within EOS.
Yeah. So yeah.
The challenge is parts, right? Parts.
Always.
Parts, parts. Challenge is always going to be parts.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, you were kind enough to forward me Martin's email, and I did correspond with him. I mean, it's actually not as bad to service because it's an ITER-based movement with a module on top. I mean, what he did tell me, though, is he gave me some real good pointers to pass on to the next watchmaker, and, you know, don't dismantle the EOS module. You know, just take it off in one piece. This is how you do it. So it was actually really helpful. And, you know, that we can veer off to a different discussion, but about all these sort of servicing of watches for brands that are no longer active. You know, I hear this a lot from collectors who are like, oh, I'm reluctant to buy an independent watch because what happens if the brand is no longer there? And my response to that is everything is ultimately fixable, right? If we can fix a Abraham Louis Breguet pocket watch from 1797, if we can get it ticking today, we can get insert brand fixed now, with the caveat that it's made with traditional materials, traditional crafts, traditional skills, right? I mean, if you buy a HYT watch, which has recently went out of business and then came back.
I think I'm going to say there are some avant-garde manufacturers out there. Like you mentioned HYT. If the fluid comes spilling out of that thing, what am I supposed to do next?
See a doctor.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right, yes.
The thing about Buitelainen, which he is really, to your point, steadfast about, is not using materials that may or may not exist at some point in the future. So he has stayed away from silicium or silicone for hair springs and, you know, pallet forks and whatnot, where the major manufacturers have moved to those parts almost exclusively. So he sees it as you see it. He wants to sell a watch that's serviceable in 100 years.
Yeah. And look, and there is a time and a place.
That point.
Yeah. Time and a place. Because I can also foresee a thing is if you're a watchmaker who makes something really futuristic, future facing, future forward, I can't even think about it, but Leader Konstantin Chaikin, let's say, and I mean, he does traditional stuff, so he's a terrible example, but if you had a manufacturer who was using
Grubel Forsey's perfect example.
So I can foresee a time where, you know, Grubel Forsey ceased to exist anywhere between 20 years and 100 years time, but there will be a time where Grubel Forsey is no longer with us and their entire output might be, I don't know, you know, 2000 watches, right? I have this thing of, you know, some people have this succession plan. Oh, what will happen when Kari Buitelainen dies away, you know, when he passes on at some point? And will his daughter continue or will she let the brand go? And some people are passionate about, no, she has to carry on. I mean, not even Kari Buitelainen, let's go Philippe Dufour. Philippe Dufour is actually a perfect pressing example right now. So bless the man, he's still working, but he's in his 70s, clearly, you know, heading to greener pastures. God bless him. You know, he's done a lot of work for the community and the watchmaking craft. He deserves his rest. So at some point, Philippe Dufour retires. And in my head, I'm like, that's fine. We can let that brand go. You can close the book on the brand, just like we don't expect the children of artists carrying on now. You know, no one's expecting great, great, great grandson of Van Gogh painting sunflowers again just because his grandfather, or, you know, Van Gogh's probably not the best example, he's never had kids, but you know what I mean. Like, you know, Jackson Pollock's great-grandchildren aren't doing spill painting.
Well, I think to your point, Van Gogh is the great example because he did not have any nepotism. Yeah. He does not have a tradition to pass on. And this tradition, this living art that you and I are so passionate about is multi-generational. You know, you look at the family of Georges Lecoultre, or you look at the family of Patek Philippe, or you even, you know, you look at the family of the Rolex. You know, I don't know that anybody was worried that Wilsdorf was going to pass away without any heirs.
Sure.
So in that regard, you know, your point is well taken. To go back to Kari's daughter, he bought her a watch company so that she would stick around. So you know, he's a very unique guy.
Sure. Well, he's a very business savvy guy.
You know, he's very unique. very business savvy. Like a Ludovic Balloard, his watches are so avant-garde. How are they going to get serviced if one goes down? And going back to the Grubel Forzi example, these are $300,000-$500,000 pieces of watches. Sure. You know, these are expensive, very rare birds. So, like, I guess, like any kind of rare Ferrari, somebody's able to find an alternator for it. Exactly. Somebody can make something for it.
Oh, look, I agree, and I see it as. You know, we had a previous guest a while ago was Todd Levin, who's, I think, he's an art advisor who works with really high-end clients securing works of art for their collections. And we were talking about sort of restoration and conservatorship of significant works of art. And he was saying, you know, and so my question was, you know, if somebody buys a Picasso is 100 years old now, you know, surely the canvas will wear a bit thin and the frame will need restoring and new nails. How do you balance the preservation versus restoration? And his, I think, answer was, well, it's a delicate balance, but you do it because you can't let the artwork go to ruin. So you have to at some point preserve it, restore it, not modernize it, but make sure that it survives with potentially appropriate materials. But it's never going to be a untouched Picasso because they're just, with passage of time, it will deteriorate. So it would be the same, I think, for a Kari Vuutilainen watch 100 years down the line. You know, you can't let it triple sealed in Geneva air. At some point, somebody will need to open up and dig it up. And if the dial gets a bit discolored, somebody will need to do a bit of patch. So just skilled craftsmen will always look after a significant object. So, but also I am less precious about, you know, independent watchmakers or horological artists feeling the pressure to somehow preserve their legacy for nine generations, because I think we don't expect that from any other music artist, painter, sculptor, whatever. You know, once they're done, their body of work is done. We can do a catalog resume, close the book, move to the next guy or girl, for that matter. You know, lady, whoever's making them.
Well, and I think it's a very interesting. We have veered off topic, which is fine because you and I could talk for 4 hours.
That's good. We can come. We'll come back.
You know, to your point, let's talk about a George Daniels,
perfect.
Who passed down was to a Roger Smith, you know. So there was some preservation of that legacy. And, you know, you look at a guy like George Daniels, and I know you're a huge fan. You and I have read a number of his books and not be able to comprehend 80% of it, but we read it 100%. Anyways. Yeah, I mean, the guy was on a whole other plane. He was on a whole other level of watchmaking. And to your point about David Walter, he also followed the tradition of Breguet, as I believe still 300 years later, most of them do.
Yeah. So. I mean, the Daniels Roger Smith example is really interesting because I talked to quite a few sort of collectors and, you know, enthusiasts about it. I mean, Roger's a brilliant mind. In some ways, I feel, you know, whenever Roger Smith gets interviewed, you know, the tell us about your time with Daniels comes up all the time. And you kind of go, that was a small part. You know, he's got a career of his own. He's advanced the Daniels work, the coaxial escapement, significantly. You know, he's doing technical stuff with longevity of movements, reducing tension and components. Like, Roger's really going technical excellence well beyond. But, you know, everyone still anchors there. Tell us about your time with George Daniels. What's really interesting about the Daniels-Smith transition, at least for me, is Roger was very savvy by plan or not, by saying, you know, I'm not going to do the George Daniels watches. When George passes away, I will continue making the watches that George sold in that collection of 35, the anniversary pieces, which I think are still being made. But Roger said, no, I've got my own thing. So I am making Roger Smith watches. So he's still, so Roger's making his own watches, but then I think alongside it, they're still completing that 35 series. They might be nearly done or they might still have, I'm pretty sure I saw one that he recently completed. So they're still being made. But Roger, there's a Roger Smith company. It's not a George, it's not a Daniels of London company that Roger is leading. He's like, no, I closed that chapter when George passed away. And that's what I think what makes the Daniels watches really special is that there's only 23 pocket watches and 4 wristwatches that the man made. That's it. That's his oeuvre. That's the time bracket where George was alive. That's what he made. Roger can service them for you. So there is a succession plan in terms of if you're lucky enough to have a Daniels and it needs work, send him to Roger Smith. You know, the workshop is there, Georgia's stuff is there, materials are there, all of that is there. But if you want to buy a Daniels watch today, you have to buy it at auction. Roger's not going to make you a Daniels watch. He'll make you a Roger Smith watch if you wait 8 years or whatever. Bless him, he's got a long waiting list, which is great. But I think that's really the best way to do it. I mean, I think that's the perfect succession plan. So I always think of, you know, Daniela Dufour, probably not my place to comment either, but, you know, Daniela Dufour stepping into Philippe Dufour's brand to carry on his work. I mean, she is setting herself up to a really impossible dilemma, right? Even if she is a better watchmaker than Philippe ever was, and obviously she isn't now, but she might get to it. Even if her watches are objectively better than Philippe's down the line, I am betting you now that any Dufour collector will want a Dufour watch, well, when the old man was around, even if it's not as well made, as compared to a Daniela Dufour watch. Now, it's an impossible conundrum, right? I would rather see her make a Daniela Dufour watch, but still be there to service Philippe's watches for the collectors down the line. You know, you've got a Philippe Dufour watch, send them to Daniela. She's got all his notebooks. She knows exactly what to do. She can ask the man if she needs to. But if you want a modern Dufour watch, get a Daniela Dufour watch. It's an impossible thing, I think.
It does seem like the natural progression of things. And, you know, these guys are so special, what they do, and their patronage is so special. I was asking Tim, how did these guys do it before? Mm. And he says, you know, they have a very small group of very wealthy patrons, yes, who will essentially buy just about anything, sure, they make. And that's good for them, you know, and good. And I guess when the internet finally came in, that's what really gave them the exposure that they never had before. Now, Kari, as we know, he only makes maybe 35, 40 watches with the name Voutilainen on. But there's so many other watches he makes. Yes. He makes for MB&F. He makes for Strehler. He makes for all the people. The Groenefelds now get their dials from Kari. You know, so there's all this great community stuff between them. And I think it's great because it's really sort of an adjunct of our community.
Yeah. Well, Kari is unique, I think, in that sense where he has built up empire is a strong word, but he has built up, you know, there's a dial factory, Voutilainen-Catran. There is a case making factory, I think Voutilainen-Catan or something, you know. So he is doing his own work, but he's really creating this infrastructure to A, alternative sources of income, but also supporting the other independents who can now get dials, like a Satori Biard, for example, can get a dial or whatever it is, right? So, and that's a genius move. I don't think we've seen that. I don't think we've seen a player like Kari in the indie space who is that business savvy and also that good of a watchmaker. You know, usually those two skills are not necessarily, it's a Venn diagram without significant overlap, right?
Exactly. It is not like this. It's not that Venn diagram, right? It is not that little space in there. No. So for our friend Martin, one of the most creative guys you and I know, I mean, the watches that were
100%.
But he had to learn his business acumen along the way, and his business savvy came a little late.
Mm.
You know, Kari, I don't want to beat the Kari Voutilainen drum too much, but definitely a unique fellow in our world. Mm. Definitely very unique. Romain Gauthier, very unique.
Mm.
Guys that understand that they need to make stuff for other people to be successful. Yes. Armin Strom, yes, these two guys are great guys.
Yeah.
So it's good that the watch community has its people that are like Rolex wants nobody near them. Audemars Patek, don't come near me.
Well, allegedly.
But then what does Audemars do? Then they have a Renault and Poppy, and they say, okay, well, come on in here, Vianney Halter. We'll make our watch for you. So again, that community piece is still flowing around.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I mean, Martin, I often reflect on kind of the Martin Braun generation of independent watchmakers, because I think they paved the way for the current guys and girls, but they don't get any credit. So I look at Martin Braun's a classic example, brilliant watchmaker, really innovative stuff, really far sight into kind of, you know, using base movements to create really in-house complications, which no one had seen before. But the collector community wasn't there. You know, the Martin Braun, the Elaine Silberstein, the Sven Anderson to some degree, the Vincent Calabresi to some degree. You know, those guys broke down the door for the Recepis and, you know, Kari Vuitilainen in some ways, you know, and all the kind of the later generation of indies. But the older guys don't really, or at least maybe I'm misreading it, or maybe I'm too far away from Switzerland to know. I don't feel they get enough respect. Even Frank Mueller, you know, if we think about Frank Mueller, the original Frank Mueller, when he was still making, you know, stuff with love rather than just pumping stuff out. I don't know. It always makes me sad because I think those guys missed out both financially and reputationally to some degree.
Martin, to your point, might have been maybe 10 or 12 years too early.
Definitely.
He got into bed with Watchland, with Frank Mueller.
Yes, that was unfortunate.
And I think they bought him to dismantle him. That maybe is a discussion for another podcast. Right. But to your point, guys like Frank Mueller don't get the credit they deserve. Martin doesn't get the credit they deserve, but they did pave the way.
No question.
For these Kadokes.
Yeah, no question. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Mm. You know, and just to go back to Roger Smith for a second, you know, if George Daniels decided, I think, I'm going to show the world that the Brits can make watches too.
Yes.
You know, people think in our world that there's just these Swiss watches, but my Grail watch is made in Germany, and I want a long and sewn, you know. So as far as watchmaking goes, I love to see these countries that have these, you know, the Habrings in Austria, for example, these organic watch creators that are really want to show the world that good watchmaking, classic watchmaking, can come out of a place like England or Austria or, you know, Kadok's German, right?
Yeah.
But am I saying his name right? Asiaki, you know, the guy who's self-taught.
Yeah, Hajime Asaoka. Yeah,
Hajime. Guy's self-taught. And when he shows his watches to a Swiss watchmaker and they look at him like, what? They're troubled.
Sure.
They're really troubled.
I was going to say, the self-taught's really interesting. We've got a self-taught watchmaker working in Australia, Ruben Scoots, who's a young guy who discovered kind of George Daniels while recovering from this really severe illness. So he was bedridden for a year. He contracted some virus, I think it was. And so he was lying in bed reassessing his life as a young man and discovered George, the watchmaker. It's a story made for like a, you know, Hallmark movie, daytime movie, right? He was lying there, you know, life flashing past, and, you know, his eyes fall on a book that somebody left to prop a door open or something, and it happens to be, you know, that kind of story, right? You know, cue the violins kind of thing. Lovely guy, but, you know, doing it tough, you know, but learning his way, trying to forge his own path step by step. Yeah, it's a lovely story. And those guys tend to come out with interesting stuff because they come from their watchmaking is not formed by a rigid WASTEP training program, right?
Exactly. They haven't been subject to the rules.
Yes, they haven't been limited. That's exactly. Yeah.
You know, there's the great Audemars Piguet catchphrase after, you know, you see the big AP and it says, to break the rules, you must first master.
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
AP. Yeah. But these guys, they'd never put a toe into WOSTEP. So they have a whole different.
Yeah.
Way of thinking, you know.
Yeah, oh, don't get me started on AP.
I love avant-garde watchmaking. I love avant-garde. I love what Ludovic Balloart is doing. I love stuff that's just not, you know, I think you mentioned HYT. Right?
Yeah.
I think they're out of business.
No, they're back. They're back now. They're back now. They were briefly out of business. From what I understand, and I could be wrong, and I'll say allegedly now so that they don't sue us, but there was something to do with debt restructuring or something. You know, it was a strategic bankruptcy or what it, like, don't quote me, I'm not an economist, but it was a strategic move to reconsolidate, move to the, you know, a different tax jurisdiction or something. I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But look, I'm not a
huge fan. I appreciate the watches, but not a fan.
Yeah, look, I vacillate. I like that they exist. They're clearly not for me. I mean, both in terms of, you know, I prefer more classical stuff, but also, you know, the price branch, it's never going to be a realm of possibility. So they exist, but it doesn't impinge on my wallet in any way. I like that they exist. I really like that they exist. My only gripe is that if you're that avant-garde and you do stuff that is that advanced, that uses completely different technology to everyone else in the industry, I think you have a moral obligation to the owners of your watches to publish your intellectual property if you go out of business. So I have a thing of, you know, if you're making your watches with wheels and levers and springs, the skilled watchmakers and engineers will figure it out, no problem. But if you make something with bellows and a whistle and a thing and a fluid, if you go out of business, the people who've bought your expensive watches are out in the lurch, right? So my thing is, well, don't do that. Publish the thing. We have similar problems with automata now, right? So somebody made an automaton 300 years ago, 400 years ago, and they're all one-off pieces, and they often have bellows and, you know, like singing birds.
You mean like a
Jacques Draw? Yeah, like a Jacques Draw. Right, that kind of, you know, they're all one-off pieces. They're all individually made. There's no blueprints, but they are devilishly hard to repair now because every one of them is often uses completely different power source. The way the sound is made, the bellows are all different, you know, so repairing them is a real pain. So my thing would be is if you're making the equivalent of an automaton now in the 21st/22nd century, whatever century we end up getting to, you have some kind of obligation if somebody buys your $500,000 watch that is so out there that no one else knows how to make it. If you as a company, as a maker, don't survive, publish the information. It won't matter to 99.999% of the population or even the industry because you're so out there. But if I have your watch, I need to be able to find an engineering firm. It's a much easier thing to go, I can bring you the blueprints if I give you can you reverse engineer this and make it if I give you the CAD files or whatever, as opposed to, well, no, I don't know how it's made either. You guys figure it out because your repair bills are 10 times as much. Your possibility of success is 10%. Like, I don't know. It's just I have this, you know, possibly stupid thing of I like that these avant-garde things exist, but I also like to see a bit of responsibility from the maker to the collector. Maybe it's just me.
And I think that's right. And I think that, you know, we'll go back to Grubel Forzi. And I have a Antoine Martin Quantium Perpetual Tourbillon.
Oh, lovely.
Which had a problem with the date pivot because it's got a retrograde date at 3. And I gave it to a watchmaker friend of mine. He spoke to Martin. Martin said, don't disassemble it.
Yeah.
Just take the dial off and you'll be able to get to this thing, this pivot, and I'll send you the pivot. Well, this clown dismantled the whole watch.
Gosh. Yeah.
And probably this is not a mystery to you, but the watch is still completely disassembled sitting in Martin's shop.
Sure.
In
Marbach. It's just one of those things you kind of go, and that's what I mean. If you had clear instructions from the maker, you know, they came with a watch said, do this, don't do that.
He had clear clear instructions.
Yeah, clear Germanic instructions, not just clear instructions, but clear Germanic instructions.
Yeah, yeah, they were said with a little more force.
Yeah, oomph, that's right, the Wagnerian soundtrack to go with it. Okay. I feel like
it's right. Even the word "wunderbar" is said. It's said angry. Wunderbar. I mean, my God, Germans, take it easy. You know.
No, we've gone really deep. I had a whole thing prepared, and I totally forgot what we were going to talk about. Oh no, do you want to talk about what you want to talk about?
Well, bring us back.
Bring it in.
We were going to talk about. I live in Los Angeles.
Yep.
And it's no good to. It's no good to wear an expensive watch in my town right now.
Yes.
Now, these are not inexpensive watches that you and I are wearing today.
Sure.
But the good thing about this is nobody really knows what it is.
No.
Right? So my Rolex watches are now in a box in the bank.
Mm.
My Patek is in a box in the bank. My anything that anybody would see and know what it is.
Recognizable. Yeah, recognizable.
Away.
Yeah.
Now, my last name, Goldman, I don't own any watches that have any gold.
Yes.
Goldman seems to be enough gold for anybody. So I'm really under the radar. But a buddy of mine was relieved of his Submariner about 3 months ago.
Oh, wow.
And it was, you know, stainless steel.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. Hopefully your buddy's okay.
He has since recovered it.
Wow.
No, he has since recovered it.
Yeah,
they got the guy, and he had a lot of other stuff. It's interesting how they caught the guy. He brought some watches into Rolex to be serviced.
Oh, God. I mean, what an idiot.
Yeah, not
the brightest.
Not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Yeah, so in L.A., like, okay, I don't drive my 911 anymore. I drive a Kia.
Sure.
That, you know, I love.
Sure.
I've decided to get completely under the radar in my town.
Yeah.
You know? And as avid watch collectors, we like to show, you know, we're men. This is our one piece of jewelry that's
sure.
justifiable to wear. And I don't think I want to be sitting at lunch and have somebody come up and relieve me of a Rolex. It's just not worth it.
Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, we all see those stories. Yeah. We all see those stories.
So, you know, everybody knows everything that's going on here. And
Can I ask you something? Because I'm curious about this. So does that experience of not being able to wear your stuff or enjoy your watches or even your cars or whatever, but let's just stay with watches. Does knowing what you know and the visibility, does it detract or drive you away from this collecting passion? Does it just kill the joy? Or does it kind of, you still enjoy it, but in private or something?
Wow, what a great question. It's both. It's both. First of all, I don't think guys like us, I don't see our passion ever waning. I think we love this world. These men who make this stuff are incredible artists and of deep intellect.
Sure.
So that appreciation factor will always be there. Am I buying less watches? Yeah. Do I have my eyes on one or two? Definitely.
Mm.
They're way out of my price range.
Well, that's always the
you way. Mentioned price before, like an HYT. Yeah. But to your point, you know, even if the resources were there, there are watches that I would never want to buy. HYT, one of them. I think the Grubel Forzi watches are stunning, but not for me.
Mm.
Richard Mille, great. Not for me. Mm. Long and Sona, I will tell you right now, my Grail watch has been and will be until I get it, this massive Long and Sona that runs for a month.
Yeah, 31 day. Yeah, I remember you talking about it when we were talking about it. It's
days.
Still your Grail. That's amazing. It's still your Grail.
Correct.
Yeah. Magical. Yeah, it's
still my Grail. And I could sell my Porsche to get it.
Sure.
My 1995 911 is worth more than like a brand new one.
Sure.
But you know what? Again, what would I do with it? To your
well,
question.
Well, that's right. That's
I'd probably get it.
Yeah. That's what I mean. I mean, that's the thing I find really troubling is that I can foresee, you know, if I, fortunately, I don't live in a town where those kind of robberies and things happen or at all, or at least with that regularity. But people here are also not comfortable wearing the watches that they have, the visibly known watches. You know, we're talking Pateks, Rolex in particular, because that's instantly recognizable to everybody. I mean, people are not wearing them now. And, you know, and I don't collect Rolex at all, but that would, if I was into mainstream horology, you know, because we're into independent watchmaking. We're crazy as it is. We're a whole level of idiot below the regular normal idiots, and we're kind of completely insane. But if I wasn't into independent watchmaking, and if I was just into Rolex, let's say I just, you know, but I couldn't wear them outside, I mean, I would just turn away from the watch hobby. I think it would kill it for me. What's the point of having them in a box here? At least you and I can console ourselves with fairy tales of we're supporting the craftsmen and all of that, and somebody lovingly, you know, slaved over this thing. We've got a fairy tale. People at Rolex, what are the, people with Rolexes, what are they telling themselves? Like, if you can't wear it out to show people that you've got another Rolex, what's the point? I don't know. Like, I don't know.
Well, and to that point, you know, you say you don't own any Rolexes, no. And I know many watch collectors who don't. You know, you read my story about the doctor and what makes the watch collector tick, and he's got hundreds of watches, and not a single one is a Rolex.
Oh, this is Mitch we're talking about. Oh, what a legend.
Mitch, yeah, legend.
Still my favorite episode of any podcast ever made.
Ah, you beautiful man. Mitch is a unique fellow. I think he owns some Rolexes, but he won't admit it. That's sure. Just me.
Sure.
And, you know, the guy can afford whatever he wants. He's got an amazing watch collection, but the Rolex is just boring to him.
Sure.
And I get it. Rolex is really, in our world, a very unique, mad cult item. It's not even really a watch. To me, a Rolex is currency. You sure. Can spend $8,000 on a Rolex. You could be in some part of the world where the shit's hitting the fan, and you've got something somebody will give you $6,000 for. Bang. You could go and spend $35,000, $45,000 on a Patek Philippe, and you've got something somebody's willing to give you $6,000
for. Sure. Yeah,
so
yeah,
I think I'd rather, like, my travel watch has always traditionally been a Rolex Sub, just in the event that the fan gets hit by excrement.
It's really interesting. So I remember having a conversation with a friend of a friend, and this guy I met is an older gentleman who used to do conflict reporting. You know, so he was the guy going to, you know, Indonesia to cover the Suharto regime revolutions and stuff like that. And that's what he said. He used to say, the thing you have to have with you is a passport and something you could trade to get on the last plane out of the country at any given time. So he was, and he would often be like some kind of watch, which wasn't necessarily, you know, it wasn't a gold piece, but it was like something recognizable that the guy guarding the airport sure. would open the chain link fence to sneak you out so you can give that to him as you sneak out. So, but that would be hard to, I mean, I don't imagine those travel reporters, they can't afford a Rolex at modern prices, let alone, you know, that's one. And number two, they would get killed on the way to the airport in their own country, given how recognizable Rolex is. You don't even need to sneak it out of the country to get somewhere else, right? So that's killed that bit.
There's that.
Right. I don't know. Sorry. I mean, I get a bit grim about this, but it is really – I mean, I find Rolex distasteful. Like the miasma of kind of the exclusivity I find distasteful.
Are we grim? But are we grim or are we realistic? I mean, you know, it is – it's unfortunate – that this is where I live. It's unfortunate that if you drive a nice car, somebody's going to follow you home from the market. That's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that a lot of us have to, if we're going to be wearing something expensive, have to have some heat on us, you know? That's going to make a difference, because if somebody puts a gun in your face and wants your watch, you're not reaching for your gun. You're giving them your watch.
Well, Hopefully.
So I would rather, for me at this stage, I'm going to say something totally unpurist. My favorite watch right now, Roman, is my titanium G-Shock.
Sure. I hear that all the time. I hear that all the time from watchmakers, mind you. The number of watchmakers I've spoken to who either don't wear a watch at all, like particularly in the workshop, but even outside, or they wear a G-Shock, you know, 100%. I totally get it.
I'm in love with anything titanium. I swear to God, if Rolex released a titanium watch, I would buy it. I love titanium, and I don't even know why.
First of all, you wouldn't buy it. You would go on the waiting list for your grandchildren to buy it. Let's be realistic here, right? So, so you know, which is my problem with Rolex right now.
I'm still on the waiting list for a Daytona, I think. So, yeah, you're right.
Well, I can promise you I'm not holding up inventory. So it's not because I'm also on the waiting list for that. You can have my one. You know, that's fine. Well, I think that's partly the problem. I mean, partly my problem with Rolex is the lack of transparency in that waiting list as well. You know, so let's say they come out with a watch that you really like and you go to your local insert name dealer. And they'll go, oh, we don't have one available, but we'll put you on the waiting list. And you'll go, well, what number am I on the waiting list? They'll go, oh, it's hard to say. Well, you're 105th. And you go, well, how many do you get a month? They'll go, oh, we'll get 3. So in your head, at least if it's a transparent waiting list, you can go, all right, well, it's 36 months, 4 years I've got mine. But that's not how the waiting lists work at all. There's this complicated bullshit strategy of, what else can you buy? Do you have a history with that? Like all of that, I refuse to play those sort of games because in my head, Rolex ain't good enough to be, it ain't exclusive enough to think they're that special in my, you know. So give me a transparent waiting list, I'll start respecting you. Otherwise, you know, get lost. And, you know, so, but
yeah, I don't know. You know, to your point, you and I are certainly as independent watch maker collectors. You and I are more than seasoned to understand, here's your $9,000 now, and here's your other $9,000 when you deliver my watch.
Sure.
You and I understand that's how it should be with an independent watchmaker who's making it with these.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have to wait 2 years for a stupid Rolex where they make a million of them a year. So yes, you're exactly right.
Exactly. Look,
they're playing games, and it's not right.
No, and it just leaves a bad taste.
That's why I went off Panerai. It leaves a very bad taste. Panerai, back in the day, was one of my favorite brands before they just became this. I mean, I'm all for Sylvester Stallone and making a brand popular, but now they've just gone completely away from their DNA.
Yeah,
they charge a stupid sum of money. Their watches are made like crud. Which is really a shame because the Richemont group usually has a pretty high standard, right? Richemont owning Cartier, Jaeger LeCoultre, Long & Sona, Vacher & Constantin. My God.
Sure.
They own one of the crown jewels. So you would think they wouldn't allow Panerai to slide into a shitstorm. But they did. So
yeah, I think,
what can I tell you?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think you and I, we've both, you know, we were both enjoying watches at the time where Panerai was hot, you know, and very desirable. So I think we both hold this nostalgic memory of vestigial memory of Panerai being desirable. And, you know, if any Panerai brand executives are listening, do give us a call. We can help with advice to kind of get you back on the right track. I think partly it was easy money. My impression of Panerai was it was easy money. They got lazy. They got complacent and lazy. And what happened, I think, was everyone who wanted one easily.
I think that's exactly right. I think the Richemont people, I think, well, Rupert, I think the guy, you know, the guy who runs.
Yeah, the thing. Yeah.
Richemont, I think he was like, oh, that's my hot brand. I don't have to spend a lot of money there. Let them go cheap and I'll make, it's like, he's like selling mattresses, you know, with this huge margin. The mattress costs $10 to make. I sell it for $3,000. Everybody's happy. You know, the shareholders have certain demands. I wish they chose a cruddier brand, but it's just me, you know. You and I could go in and save a lot of brands. I would love a Reverso if it was a little bigger.
Yes, and better priced.
You know, it needs to be a little bigger.
And better priced.
Well, the price of that's true. And titanium. Why not make me a Reverso in titanium? I'd actually buy it.
Sure. Well, they're quite chunky, aren't they?
Yeah, I tell you, there's a couple watches I'm in love with that are less expensive. I think my next watch will be a Tudor. Wow. I am mad crush in love with this Tudor. That's the ceramic Tudor with the fancy movement in it. That's all cost.
Okay.
Competing with the Omega.
Okay.
That watch I love, and it's under the radar, and I could wear it, and nobody cares. Sure. So that could be my next watch.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you what's next in between that and the 31-day, I can never pronounce the model name, Langer and Zuna.
The 110. I really like that line of Tudor watches. I don't even know why. I know they're very Rolex.
Yeah.
But they've kind of come into their own over the last number of years, and I really, really love them. Crazy that the avant-garde watches are really what's driving me right now. I've been waiting a long time for my Ludovic Balawarn watch.
Did you order one?
Yeah, it's been ordered for a long time.
That's amazing.
But he's got half the money. He's had half the money for a long time, but I told him, it's got to be piece unique in titanium.
Well, we guessed titanium.
And he said the only way he can do it is if he makes 10 of them in titanium. He has to do 10 of them.
Okay. Wow. So do we go on and put out a call
for 9 pieces? If he does the 10, that's fine. But my dial needs to be piece unique. So we're still not there.
Sure. Well, it's an evolution. That's amazing. Oh, congratulations. That's an awesome thing. He's great. Well, again, another one of those.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean,
under the radar.
It's another year. It's another year at least, you know, and like Voutilainen, I've probably sent $700,000, $800,000 worth of business to Balawarn. And I think if there was some way for you and I to get better will out of these guys that we love so much because of the business we've driven to them, that would be helpful. That'd be very nice. Ludovic's giving me a very, very nice deal. I shouldn't complain. Yeah. I can't even see how I would ever own a Voutilainen.
The train for those have gone for me, certainly. Ludovic is great. I mean, I still feel the thing I find with independent watchmakers is the brands that do well need to have a personality behind it who can communicate it very well or be kind of mysterious enough but still visible. You know, so like if we think like who's, you know, Max Bucer is a stellar example of a super charismatic guy who can explain to you whatever he's making. And it doesn't matter what it is, you fall in love with it. At least I do. You know, whatever it is, it's a bulldog, it's a frog, it's a spaceship. You're like, it's not, but you know, it's not something I would look at twice.
Who knows what the fuck it is?
Doesn't matter, right? The way, by the time he finishes telling you about it, you start thinking, well, how many kidneys do I need to survive? And, you know, look, do I need both feet? What are they paying? Yeah, because
Well, there's another brand like that. Is this Ferdinand Berthoud?
Yes.
This Ferdinand Berthoud.
Yeah. Absolutely insane. Yeah.
Or let's just talk about the Groeneveld 8-second Remontois. Or yes, I don't even know what the purpose of that latest thing they put out with the sort of
chronograph, the double chronograph sort of thing.
Not, but that 8-second Remontois. Yeah, whatever that. That's not for me. You know, you and I have even talked about a guy like Jorn. You know,
well,
look at what Jorn's done in the world of independence. So,
well, Jorn is kind of the other side. So Jorn is really interesting because Jorn is, in my mind, the anti Max Bucer. So Max Bucer is this really personable. I can explain everything. I'm connecting with my buyers. I'm building a tribe. I'm here for you, Jorn. In my experience, it is non-VIP. Jean is very standoffish. Maybe it's French. They're like, no, you have to, when you get mature enough to buy my watches, you come begging on your knees, and then I will think about it. Like, Jean, it's beneath me to talk to you. So that's what I mean. Yeah. That's the mysterious founder, right? Doesn't communicate, at least in my experience, well, but has enough passionate people.
Well, I don't mind that. I don't mind that arrogance so much.
But the thing is, I find, you know, with guys like Ludovic Balawarn, or there's a few others where they're supremely talented, but kind of not front facing enough to explain how special they are. well enough. I mean, Debethune had this problem for years and years and years. They were an amazing brand, making incredible watches. You know, Denis Flageolet is a genius, no question. But they didn't have a compelling presence or a maker or somebody to explain what they were all about. And I found that that really hurt them for a while. So I think that's where Ludovic would be better known, I think, if he was a bit more forward-facing. Maybe that's just an impression.
I think that's right. He's a pretty gregarious guy. He's got a very definite base of patrons. But you mentioned another brand that I wanted to come back to, Debethune. Yeah. You know, these guys are alchemists.
100%.
And they have a whole other kind of approach to this craft. And they are under the radar, which I think is good, but there's lots of brands that are under the radar. You know, you look at a company like H. Moser and see, that stuff is unbelievable. And you look at the watch that Jonathan and I did for Icon, and had we been able to do it, we would have been the first Vanta Black dial in the watch world.
That was the doozy, wasn't it? That was the Icon doozy.
That was the doozy. The Icon doozy, and there were 50, and they're gone. But can you imagine, had we come out to the marketplace with this Vanta Black finish on our dial, who are these guys? This guy makes cars. Who's this guy?
Well, you guys were a bit early.
Well, this guy is a great designer.
You guys were early. Too early. Like 3 or 5 years, I think.
We were too early. The partner that we picked didn't have the partner we picked didn't have the right
thing, right? Mix of stuff. Right.
Balls, I guess. Yeah.
Which once again, we don't want to veer too hard into it, but that is important, right? I mean, launching a brand is really hard, so you gotta timing, luck, positioning, all of that. Just making something cool is not enough, right?
Just making something cool is not enough. There needs to be some history, some there's provenance in some of the watches that you and I own. You know, there's history, there's family, there's a whole connection that takes place through a single watch.
Sure.
You and I, we're connected because of a watch.
Correct.
Maker.
Martin Braun. Actually, at some point, there was talk about getting Martin back up and running.
That's what I was about to say. I would love to get Martin back up and running. But kind of based on what we've circling back around now as we probably get to the close of our thing here, he doesn't want to do it anymore.
Which?
The most creative guy that I know.
Yeah.
Now, I pissed him off a couple weeks ago because I said to him, listen, I've got an idea for a watch. He goes, oh, whatever. What's your idea?
Yeah.
And I'm walking the dog. Sure. I said, wow, would it be cool if I had a watch that, if I'm looking at the watch like this, it's telling me the time on Earth. But then I push this button and the hands move around and now it's telling me the time on Mars.
Sure. You might need to pick a different planet though.
What? I mean.
Constantin Chaikin's got the Mars thing, you know. Steer clear from, you know, don't pick Uranus, but other than that, all planets are available. Just from a marketing point of view, Uranus is not.
Yeah. But the way that he did it is not the way I'm describing.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Well, you can make that happen.
I want two movements in the watch. I want two heartbeats. One heartbeat running on Mars time, one heartbeat running on our time, simultaneously. So when you push this button, the hands move around, the data
adjusts. Listen, I'm not a watchmaker.
Jenkins' watch doesn't
do
that.
I'm not a watchmaker, but surely we can make that happen. Surely we can use the base movement from a Langer and Zuna triple split that can do a, you know, that splits seconds, minutes, and triple I think does hours as well. And if you can have it running all the time, so that when you push, it's like a chronograph that's always running, and then when you push the button, the Earth time stops and the other one maybe jumps to the whatever, and then anyway, I'm sure we can figure it. If you're a watchmaker listening to this now, give Scott a call because he's clearly got the concepts already. If it's pitched to the right level, I'm sure we can make it happen. We need to work out pricing strategy first.
Well,
we can do it.
But like I said, I pissed our friend off because now he tells me he thinks no. Now he thinks of nothing else.
Ah, nice.
Now he's thinking about.
So you've dropped the seed in there, and so we need to put a timestamp on this. This is 11th of August, 2022. If that watch comes out,
or 10
August. Or that's 10 right. 10 time. August in 2022 in California. So if that watch comes out from another manufacturer, you know where you heard it first. We've got, you know, we need to do this legalistic thing. You know, you're a US based. We need to do this stuff properly. But the thing is, what I like about this
to that point, sorry to interrupt, but to that point, go look at the Vacher and Constantine.
I know where you're going with this.
I think it's called it's got Martin's EOS hands on it, for God's sake. Yeah.
Well, but I think, you know, it's one of those things, right? You kind of go,
anyway.
One of the reasons I really wanted to get you on the podcast, I mean, actually just wanted to push record on a conversation we have, is we just veer off to like all these different topics, but we start like 10 watch companies whenever you and I talk about it, or like 9 concept watches have already happened, right, in our heads. That's awesome. That's why I love talking to you, man. That's just pure passion, just crazy people talking about crazy shit. That's great. So good.
Great, man. We got to keep doing it. You are great. I thank you for the time. So great to spend some time.
It's a pleasure. There's so much we didn't even talk about you. I mean, I had this whole thing of like, tell us about your pathway into horology and all that. Next episode, it's the Scott Goldman tapes.
Next one.
We clear the schedule. Like, it's a half day workshop, and we just talk about you.
I love it, and I'll bring way more watches next time. I'll go to the bank, and I'll even talk about the very first Rolex I bought when I won money at the craps table.
Well, so now there's a – leave them on a cliffhanger. Leave them on a cliffhanger.
That was my
answer. Yeah, beautiful. All right. Tell the fine people where they can find you on the various social media things. That where can people get in touch with you if they want to talk more?
They can find me on Facebook. It's Scott Goldman 55. If you want to find me, you can find me on the Purist Pro as Elliot 55, E-L-L-I-O-T 55. You can find me at my own website, which is reolocal.com, which is real estate owned local, reolocal.com. And anybody can email me, Roman. Scott@scottgoldman.net.
Do you want to give people your Instagram, or you don't do Instagram?
I have an Instagram. It's Goldmanstagram1. Goldmanstagram1. GoldmanStagram1.
Beautifully done. Even spelled out for the benefit of hearing impaired or dyslexics. That's fantastic. That's the kind of service we provide. Let me round this up. You know, the last thing we always – it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Matt. So the last thing we always say is, you know, with Fifth Wrist, we set it up as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. So for anyone listening, if you want to join us, contribute, write reviews, or come on the show, get in touch, follow Fifth Wrist on Facebook and Instagram, or on our website at fifthwrist.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast if you like, but leave us a review. It does help to spread the word and also helps us improve. Follow me. I'm at Times Roman AU, and my friend and conversational partner and just pure bundle of delight, Scott, is at Goldmanstagram1. I'm not spelling it because he's already had. Thanks for tuning in, and stay on time.
Fifth Wrist is by the community for the community. We would love you to join the crew via our group chat on Slack. Email us at contact@fifthwrist.com and join the movement.